Hi, and welcome to It's Complicated, a podcast about healthcare ethics and practice presented by the Nova Scotia Health Ethics Network, or NSHEN. I'm Marika Warren, network ethicist for NSHEN, and I'll be your host for this discussion. So we're doing something a bit different today. This podcast, which accompanies our earlier episode about goals of care conversation, will have two parts. So first, you'll hear a simulated goals of care conversation using the Serious Illness Conversation Guide. For this first segment, we have Dr. Dave Henderson, who is a palliative care physician and senior medical director, Integrated Palliative Care Network, demonstrating how a goals of care conversation might proceed. Dr. Henderson will be talking to a simulated patient, Mr. Edward Paul, who is portrayed by Theophani Pastavis. Both the earlier episode and the Serious Illness Conversation Guide will be linked in the show notes. After that first conversation, we'll be joined by Sarah Manley of the Palliative Care Network at Nova Scotia Health, and we're going to have a bit of a reflection between Sarah, Dave, and myself to reflect on the conversation that we've just heard. I'm certainly looking forward to their insights, but for now, the next voices you'll hear are Dr. Dave Henderson and Edward Paul.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Paul. I'm Dr. Henderson. I work with the palliative care team, and your oncologist asked if I drop by and say hello. It sounds like there's been some changes for you that we might be able to help with.
Hi. Yes, you can just call me Ed.
Great. Yeah. And actually, I go by Dave, and everybody calls me Dave, so that's good. We get on that same path there.
Well, nice to meet you, Dave.
Yeah. I'll start off with, I don't know if you've heard much about palliative care, if you've even heard that name before, but sometimes it evokes kind of a scary thought in a lot of people's minds. Some people think that, oh my God, palliative care is coming to see me. It means I'm in my last days. And I want to reassure you that that's not the case. With palliative care, we get involved with people often very early in trajectory of a serious illness to really try to help with people's understanding of their illness, but also if there's symptoms coming up. And I understand some shortness of breath has been a big issue for you lately. So, you know, that's one of the main reasons that they asked me to get involved is to help you get some of those symptoms better controlled, you know, with the intent of getting you back home again. But the other things that we can do if at the end of our conversation, if you want to stay connected with us, we're happy to kind of follow you along through this illness as well too. And our role is to help you do as well as you can for as long as you can, and also support your family as well to help them with their understanding. Because generally, the better we understand what's happening, the better we can deal with it and manage it. So does that sound okay to you?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I understand you came in, you were quite short of breath at home, and you came in and they did some investigations. Can you tell me what your understanding is of what's been happening?
Well, I know they did a CT scan, and I know that the cancer's moved to the other lung now. So, yes, and they gave me the pill that I've been taking, the chemo pill. But yeah, the last 2 weeks have just been it's been hard to get a breath. It's been really hard, and that's been the biggest change. And before that, I was even working part time, but I just can't now. I just can't do anything. I'm so exhausted.
Yeah, and you were diagnosed originally. Was it about a year or so ago? I understand.
15 months
with the lung cancer. Yeah. And you went through some radiation and some other chemotherapy, and now they started on this new medication. And that's been for about a month, I understand.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So it sounds like when you came in through the emergency department, you had the increased shortness of breath, you had a cough and some fever as well. You've been in hospital for a little bit now. How is your breathing feeling today?
I mean, when I'm sitting, it's a little bit better, but it's always a challenge.
Yeah. So if we used a scale, if I said 0, I'm not short of breath at all, and 10's the worst I can ever imagine. So 0 perfect, 10 the worst. How would you rate your breathing just sitting here chatting with me now?
I would say it's like 5 or or 6 maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Excuse me.
So even a 5 or 6 is pretty uncomfortable when it comes to breathing. If you were to get up and walk to the bathroom and back, say, how how much worse, if at all, would it be then?
Oh, it would be a lot worse. It'd be like 9.
Okay.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to do anything.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And the one thing that we recognize with shortness of breath is it's different than pain. You know, we can have a pain that's a 5 or 6 out of 10, and, you know, you struggle through it and you tolerate it, you know, to some extent, and we want that under control. But shortness of breath is a different animal, right? And you're living it. So not only is it uncomfortable, it's scary too. So pretty much everybody that has shortness of breath like that, it's uncomfortable. And again, it often brings on some anxiety and almost a panicky feeling like you're not going to get your next breath. Would you say that's how you've been experiencing it as well?
Yes. I'm very scared. Yeah. I'm very scared about everything that's happening right now.
Yeah, yeah. And that's very understandable. So the good things is there's lots of things we can do to help with that. So so when our breathing's uncomfortable, and I know they've started you on some antibiotics already, so that's one thing. You've been on a bit of oxygen, which you may or may not need, because again, you were doing that well a short while ago. Sometimes with an infection, your breathing get a little worse, your oxygen can drop, so you may not need to be on oxygen even going home. So, but there are other things we can do. Once we've optimized, you know, the antibiotics, things like that, then we've got other medications that can really help your breathing feel a lot more comfortable. Strangely, some of the pain medications can help quite a bit. So the morphine-like medications. So we can use little tiny doses of those, which help to work on the center in the brain that's monitoring our oxygen levels. You know how they put that little clothespin on your finger to see your oxygen levels. So there's a monitor in our brain that checks that as well too. But it also monitors how hard it is to, how hard you have to work to maintain that level. So when you get old like me, just climbing the stairs, I feel a bit short of breath, but that's because I'm out of shape. For you, you've got some mechanical stuff going on in your lung that's making it harder for you to breathe. So by using a medication like an opioid, it helps to downregulate that system so that your breathing can actually feel better. It doesn't fix things, but you feel much better. And we know that through many studies. So, and we've had lots of success with that. So that's something we could get started here today to get you feeling more comfortable right away. So that's just one of the things that we have to offer. Often in this case too, when we think about what might be causing your shortness of breath right now, looks like you may have had an infection where you've had that fever and such, and you're on some antibiotics. The other thing that can happen is with that new medication that you're on, it's called an immunotherapy. A side effect that can happen is just an inflammatory process in the lungs, we call it a pneumonitis. And sometimes taking that away for a bit and adding in a steroid can get rid of some of that inflammation and also help to get your breathing more back to normal again. So those are a couple of different things that we can do to help with that. I mentioned earlier that anxiety, that panicky feeling you get when you're short of breath. There's another medication that we can use even off and on to help with that anxiety because it is very scary. And the more anxious you get, that creates a little cycle. So you get panicky and you actually start hyperventilating a little bit. So that makes your breathing feel even worse too. So it's managing that anxiety, that shortness of breath, and then looking at the root cause of the shortness of breath and trying to improve that. So there, again, just to try to reassure you, there's lots we can do. And we're going to start that with your agreement. We'll start that today to get you feeling better. And then we'll go from there.
Absolutely. I mean, whatever it takes. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that there's something.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever had anybody say, no, I'm quite good with this shortness of breath. Thanks anyway. Because it is so distressing. Yeah. While we're on that topic, I'll bring it up. And maybe you've thought about this a little bit. When we're living with, actually, let me back up. You've had the CAT scan. It showed the disease has progressed a lot. And they talked, you've been through chemotherapies and radiation and such. You've been through this new medication. Did the oncologist talk to you about continuing on with the immunotherapy or about stopping it?
I don't really know. I know that I'm just doing it. I don't really know what's happening next. Okay. I know that I'm here.
Yeah. So, I'll be talking to your oncologist after we visit too, but you've been on the medication for not very long, but for a while now. So we'll chat with the oncologist too about whether or not that's going to be still of benefit because of the disease that's been progressing. Because again, with any of these treatments, there's risks and benefits. We want to make sure we don't do anything that's going to make you feel worse than you are or you need to be. So we'll look at that as well too. So your understanding with this medication, was it that this is something that's going to take my disease away completely or just something to help slow it down?
Well, I don't know. I've been trying to be positive about this, you know, for the past 15 months. And I really felt like there was a chance after all the radiation and the chemo. But I don't know. Now I just, because this has come up, I just think maybe just to slow it down. I don't know. I don't feel very hopeful right now.
Yeah. So is it okay if we talk about this and kind of what the road ahead might look like?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, like I said earlier, the more we can understand what's happening, the better we can deal with it and manage things. So you're right. When you get a cancer that's spread like yours has, generally it's not going to be something that you can take away completely. So there's been lots of good advances with the treatments that can help shrink disease down and help slow down the progress. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, you haven't had great luck with that so far. So we do know this disease is going to continue to progress at some rate. And that rate varies for different people. So, you know, if you want, as we move along here, we can talk a little bit about kind of timelines and things. But let's explore things a little bit further here first. I understand that other than the shortness of breath, your pain control, you've not really been experiencing any pain?
No, yeah. Not yet.
Okay. Any nausea or upset stomach?
Well, I don't eat much.
Okay.
And I don't feel good after I eat, so.
Okay. Yeah. And by not feeling good, just overly full quickly, or do you feel a little queasy?
I feel queasy.
Okay. Yeah. So again, there's some things we can do to help with that too. Question that we always ask, and you always get tired of us asking, is how are your bowels working?
Seem all right now.
Going pretty much every day?
Yeah.
A good satisfactory bowel movement?
Yes.
Okay, that's good. Okay, so those are other things that we need to make sure we stay on top of, because everything comes together to affect how you feel. You mentioned, again, that this is very new for you, and I understand you've got your wife is with you, and you've got a couple of kids?
Yeah, I have two sons, 14 and 17.
Okay. And how are they doing with all of this?
Well, I don't think they're doing that well. I mean, we don't talk about it. We don't talk about it. We know what's going on with me, but we don't have these conversations. I don't have them with my wife. And I know they're all three of them are very worried. And we just don't know how to talk about it.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and sadly, that's not an uncommon thing. You know, this is brand new territory for you. Yeah. You've never had to do this before. And it sounds like your wife and obviously your kids haven't had any experience with this either. And it's scary. So where do we start? So that's one of the things that we can try to help you with as well, too. We'll often do something called a family meeting where you can bring in not only your wife and your kids, but whoever you feel is part of your chosen family that you think would be good for them to have a good understanding of what's happening. And then also, as we can do today, talk about what the road ahead may look like and any issues that may come up and changes that may come up, but also how we can manage those, what we can do to try to help mitigate, you know, symptoms like shortness of breath. So they don't need to be as frightened by it as well, too. So those are things that are very important. And often by having a meeting like that and making sure everybody's on the same page and has the right information, then everybody knows the same thing. So it can open those doors and allow more of that communication to happen. Again, even with our kids, I think your kids were in their teens, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, 14 and 17.
Yeah. Yeah. So
my son's going to graduate in June.
And So that sounds like that's a pretty important milestone that you want to be.
I just hope I can make it to then, because that's my dream to see him graduate.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's just some extra worry there for you, isn't it?
Yes, but bringing them, like you're talking about having this meeting, I really would love that. Yeah. We need that because they need to know what's happening and how we can figure this out. Because, I mean, we haven't even, you know, talked about how to deal with, you know, our affairs if I do go,
So those are all important things to get done. It gives you peace of mind when you've kind of checked some of those boxes, and that way you can put it aside and then focus on living, you know, having good quality life and making sure you spend some good quality time together. And that's what having some of those open communications can do. It can take that elephant out of the room, so then you can focus on some good quality time, acknowledging everybody will know the same thing, because often you kind of do a dance around it and it just makes everything awkward. So honestly, from my experience, the more open we can be with our family and have open communication, it sounds strange, but everything starts to get a little bit easier. You know, it's still hard, but at least that's not a roadblock in having some of those important conversations. And especially with our kids too. We've always seen kids will do better by being allowed to be part of it. We always want to make sure that they have choices of how much, you know, they're engaged and involved. But it's important to know that they feel like you're not holding anything back from them. So they're, you know, sometimes we worry about things we don't need to worry about and that we're not getting all the information. So giving people the opportunity to know what's going on is really important. So, and happy to do that. We could arrange to do that. Let's get you feeling a little bit better, and then we can arrange to have the family come in, and we'll sit down together and go through there.
Yeah, I'd like that. Yeah.
Very good. So we also have other parts of our team too that can help with even giving, say your boys an opportunity to have somebody outside of, you know, mom and dad to talk to a little bit about this too, just because they may want to be able to talk about this, but again, they don't want to upset you. They don't want to upset, you know, their mom. So again, it's going to be good to have somebody that they can reach out to too. And even through the schools, they can be very good of having somebody to help support them as well.
Yeah, I think that would be good for them.
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah, very good. Again, right now it sounds like a lot of the focus has just been on all these changes that have been happening. The shortness of breath for sure too. And it's been a lot of information coming at you quickly. Do you find there are times that there are other things that you worry about?
I worry about everything. I worry about, you know, if I die, which, you know, I feel is inevitable, that what's going to happen to my family, and what, I mean, I'm scared of dying. I'm young. I mean, I don't sleep at night because I worry. I worry about so much. I don't know how to stop not thinking about that.
Yeah. No, and I appreciate that. I mean, like I said, this is all new. You're a young fellow. This obviously was not expected at all. So it kind of punches you in the gut pretty hard.
I want to know how long I have. I mean, is that something that you or somebody can tell me? I don't know what else to think.
Yeah. So obviously you're okay with us talking about that.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, as we said, unfortunately with this disease, it's not something, there's going to be treatments that are going to take away completely. So we know at some point down the road, you're going to die from this disease. So there are statistics that look at how many months people can live and such. But at the end of the day, when you're looking at an individual, you're not a statistic. You know, you're Ed and this is your life. What can I expect? So one of the best prognosticators that we have is looking at our functional status, which means how much are we able to get up and get around. Like you said, you were working a month ago to now, it sounds like you're having a hard time even getting from bed to bathroom and such. So that would show a pretty dramatic functional status change. But we also know that there's some factors going on here that might still be reversible. So that's the other caveat in all this. If we're on a pretty straight decline, you know, a sloping curve of decreased function over time, if you look at that curve and if it looks like, yeah, my functional, it takes about a month to see some fairly significant functional decline, then we tend to be thinking in terms of months. If we start to see things changing quicker, like going from, you know, getting up and around to only being able to be in bed in weeks, then we start thinking in terms of weeks as opposed to months. Same idea, if it's things are changing day by day, we start thinking days to maybe some weeks. And then obviously if it's changing every day, then we're thinking hours to days. So that's a very general way of looking at it. And right now that might give you a better idea of even what your prognosis might be. And again, like I said, things have changed pretty rapidly over this last month, but there are some factors there. You've had the shortness of breath, which just having a symptom that's not well controlled, that's going to change your functional status because you're short of breath when you're trying to move. So if we can improve your shortness of breath, that can actually bring your functional status back up again. You know, the immunotherapy that you're on, you know, maybe that's been actually drawing you down a little bit too. So do we need to reassess that? Is that something that's dropping your functional status as well too? You know, the infection, same idea. So if we can take some of those potential reversible things out, that may change your curve and bring it up to a flatter curve and maybe even bring you up a level or two to where you can function at a higher level. So that makes it actually even more hard to predict what your prognosis is now. But really over, you know, the next, you know, get this hurdle under your belt here and settle back down, things will become clearer. And I think really within the next 2 or 3 days, we'll see how well you can improve with some of these interventions we want to do. My feeling is that you are going to get some good relief with this and you'll be able to get back up and moving around well, enough to the point we can certainly get you home. And then we'll see how you do. So it's going to be watching how things go from there. Again, you might be able to plateau and maintain at a fairly comfortable level for a while, or we're going to see it decline again. And again, if it does decline, then again, I think we're going to be talking in terms of weeks, and we don't know for sure how many weeks, but it could still be even longer than that as well. The factors you have going for you is you're, you know, otherwise you've been a young, healthy guy, so you're able to have more strength and stamina. So one of the things we think about in palliative care too, if we can get symptoms well controlled, is actually a little bit of rehabilitation to try to get you being able to be back up and going again too. But for right now, you're dealing with, you know, some inflammation in your lungs, you've got the infection. I think over the next few days, that's going to help to tell quite a tale of how much better things can get for you with the way you respond.
Okay.
I know that's not a definite Tuesday at 4, but
it's day by day,
exactly.
Right? How every day goes.
Yeah. You did mention some things like, you know, worrying about with the family, what happens if, and I think it's always good to look at what are the real important things that you want to accomplish while you're feeling good. And again, let's check those boxes off so you don't have to worry about those things. There are things like power of attorney and one thing I'll just bring up now, we have something in Nova Scotia called a substitute decision maker, which is if you were ever really sick and you couldn't speak for yourself, who would you want to be your spokesperson for medical decision making?
Well, my wife, but yeah, it would be my, if it wasn't my wife, then it'd be my brother.
Okay. Very good. So a really important thing for them to know is, and we have a new tool that talks about what we call goals of care and levels of intervention. And it talks about how aggressive that you would want to be with some treatments. Again, now we know this disease has progressed. We know it is going to take your life at some day. So it's important for us. We want to do the right thing for you and we want to follow what your wishes and goals are. And with that, with this tool, we talk about, and you've probably heard the term before, DNR, which we don't like because that talked about do not attempt resuscitation. And it seemed like it was an all or nothing. And it's never all or nothing. So now we have a range of choices for people. So on the far right, it's full codes, intubations, if you ever, you know, heart were to stop, beating, you stop breathing, be tubes down to help you with your breathing and ICU admission and so on. To on the far left, there's something called a comfort care measure two, which is somebody who's been through a longer protracted disease. They've been through lots of treatments and such, and they've decided that, you know what, I don't want to do anything that's going to prolong my natural death. So even if I got a pneumonia, I wouldn't want to, I wouldn't even want antibiotics. Just keep me comfortable. But there's sections in between there, you know, from another comfort level where, yes, I'd still do antibiotics and things. Yes, I'd go into the hospital to have assessments and such, but I wouldn't want too aggressive interventions. There's a something called an S2 and an S1. So a couple other selective areas. I do have a copy of that tool, which I could even give you, and you could look at it, talk to your wife about it too, and try to figure out where do I think I fall in that? Or have you had any discussions about that previously, or any thoughts about where you think you might fall within that kind of?
Well, you know, my wife and I obviously haven't talked about that. I have talked about my brother because my brother's, you know, been such a great support this whole time, and I've had some conversations with him. But I know that I just would want to get it over quickly. Like I would want the comfort. I just, I don't want it to put this, my family through this for too long.
Right.
That's what I want, sure.
Okay, that sounds fair enough. And it sounds like a reasonable decision, I think, too. We could still even look at that. Yeah, I think, you know, we'll talk to your oncologist. If they had another treatment option, would you even consider taking that? That could give you some extra time?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so that brings us.
I don't want any pain. If there's pain, it's already difficult with this breathing, but I just don't want to deal with the pain.
Yeah. So again, the things with the pain, two things. One is you really haven't had much so far. So that's a good start. And you may never have pain with this disease. The second thing is, again, there's lots of things we can do to help with pain from cancer. The vast majority of time we can have pain well controlled. Would you like to talk a little bit about what the normal natural road ahead may look like?
Yeah.
Okay. So with most cancers, and actually most causes of our death, only 10% of us die suddenly. The rest of us are going to have some kind of more chronic condition, whether it be heart disease, lung disease, kidney disease, or cancers, or frailty and dementia, where we're going to have a little bit more predictable decline over time. So with cancer, it's probably it sounds weird, but the best diagnosis that the pathway is a little bit more predictable. So the normal things are some of the things you've already started to experience with changes in appetite, some weight, decrease, energy going down, and progressively just getting gradually a little weaker and more tired, needing sleep a bit more. Eventually, we get to the time where we're going to be fatigued enough that we're going to need to sleep more through the day. And eventually, we get to the point where we're sleeping all the time. That can go on for a day or two, or that could be really quite sleepy for a week or two. It varies from individual to individual. But all through that trajectory, we'll try to always make sure that, again, pain's well controlled, your shortness of breath is well controlled, nausea, all those things are managed so that you have the opportunity to be able to have as good a quality of life as you can have. And it sounds strange, but a lot of people are able to maintain a good quality of life. And I've actually had people, again, which sounds very strange, say, it was an incredibly special time for me going through this because all of a sudden the sky was bluer, the grass was greener because I wasn't taking anything for granted anymore because I knew, you know, I was on limited time. So, my goal for people is to try to help you find peace in some of this. Because you hear words like accept, you know, you need to accept this diagnosis and accept your fate. But accept is kind of a harsh word. And I don't think this sucks, you know, at the end of the day. And I think if we can find peace in it, knowing what's coming, then we still have that ability to have some really good quality of life.
Yeah. I'd like to find peace.
Yeah.
but and it does suck.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. And you never need to accept it. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we've talked about a lot of things. So just to kind of summarize, and right now I'm going to go out and speak to the nurses. We'll see about getting you started on some medication for your shortness of breath. I have no patients, so I want you feeling better today. I'll probably run back around in a little while and see how you're doing.
Okay.
With your shortness of breath, it's there all day long. So we're going to schedule some of this opioid medication for you on an every 4-hour basis. We can take it orally, or we can use it through a little butterfly under the skin. Usually with shortness of breath, and when it's as bad as you've been experiencing, I recommend that we start it with a butterfly under the skin because it just works faster. When you take an oral pill, it takes an hour to reach peak effect. When you're short of breath, you don't want to wait an hour for relief. So when you give it through the butterfly under the skin, it's reaching peak effect within about 15 minutes. So so that's what I would recommend we start with, if you're okay with that.
Yes.
And then we'll get things under control. Then we can switch over to oral medication. Again, depending on how your chest responds to these treatments that you're doing, we might not even need to stay on the opioids. But if you do, we can continue on with those. And we aim to get, if people need to stay on the opioids, we go to a long-acting preparation where you often need to take a pill just a couple times a day to keep that breathing, ideally down around that 2 or 3 out of 10, if not better. But usually if you're 2 or 3, you can function and, you know, maybe even do a little bit of work again. We'll look at that. And we'll also have some of this other anxiety medication available too, because again, of that panic feeling. So that'll be available too, that you can kind of choose when you want to take that. The nurses will have that. Often when you start the opioids, and if you get, you know, you go from that 5 or 6 down to a 2 or a 3, you kind of get confidence back again of, okay, I finally have some control back over this. And that's the scary part when you're short of breath, you've lost control. So by having that control back again, it can help you not feel so anxious because, again, you've got something that can make things better. So you may or may not even need the anxiety medication after you get started with this other one. But it's nice to have it available if you do, because it still is a scary thing when it does happen. We always start with a low dose and titrate up to what you need as an individual as well. Okay?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Side effects with the opioids. Some people are, you know, scared. You hear the word morphine and think, oh my God, that's the real strong stuff. You know, am I going to become addicted? Or I hear people die from that. Again, we start with really little doses. Are you familiar with Tylenol 3, Tylenol with codeine?
Yes.
Yeah. So one Tylenol 3 has 30 milligrams of codeine. Codeine goes to our liver and is broken down into morphine. And it's about a 10-to-1 ratio. So Tylenol 3 has 30 milligrams of codeine. That actually equals about 3 milligrams of morphine. So often we'll start you on a dose as small as 1 milligram of morphine for shortness of breath. People don't blink an eye when you say Tylenol 3s, but they hear the word morphine, it's scary. So that gives you that perspective. So we're talking about a third of a Tylenol 3. So it makes it less scary too. So if you are talking to your wife or, you know, somebody in the family gets concerned, like, oh my God, you're starting morphine, you know, this is something that could be reassuring to people to understand. Okay.
Yeah, okay. That sounds good.
Yeah. Side effect wise, most of the pain medications will cause constipation. We'll make sure you get started on something for that so we don't get you constipated. That's going to be kind of a couple of main things we'll work on there. So we'll get your shortness of breath under control. We'll talk about getting you connected with social work who could potentially help you and your wife look at speaking with the school and looking at some other supports for the kids. And we'll look at setting up a time where, you know, we can sit down with your wife and your kids and your brother, if you want, whoever you feel you want to be part of it, to have a meeting so we can do a good review and help let everybody ask their own questions. We've talked about every scary thing we can talk about. So I've got nothing else that's going to be scarier than what we've already talked about today. We'll be able to help your family understand where things are and again, understand what the road ahead can look like. There's lots of resources out there within our province with some home care help and even equipment things through Red Cross. So there's lots of things we can help support you with.
Okay, good. All right. Sounds good.
Do you have any other questions that you can think of?
I don't think so. I think it's a lot of information.
Yeah, yeah. And don't worry, you don't have to remember it all because we'll be back and I'll be pestering you again. So, and again, we're made up of a team. So we've got other palliative care docs that are working in the community, and we have palliative care nurses too, who can continue to follow you at home as well.
Okay.
So we'll keep this support in place for you. Yeah, for as long as you need it.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. All right. And I'll check back with you in a little while.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay. You're welcome.
Thank you again, Dave and Theofani, for an incredibly rich discussion that you shared with us. And now we welcome Sarah Manley to the conversation. And for the next few minutes, we're just going to explore what we've heard for a bit, thinking about both the specific conversation that we've heard, but also other conversations that might happen around goals of care in various contexts. So to start with, I'm wondering if there's anything that you want to sort of highlight about this particular conversation, things that you think were particularly notable that would be useful for people to reflect on. And maybe I'll go to you first with that, Sarah.
Sure. So Dave did a fantastic job with that consult. And he used what's called the Serious Illness Conversation Guide, which is a tool, conversation tool, for healthcare providers to help frame up conversations around serious illness. And that tool is available online by Ariadne Labs, which is a company in California. It's been tested, you know, in a number of different scenarios and populations and settings of care. So it has a lot of evidence to back up its effectiveness and use. But I think what I'd say that you may have noticed or not in the conversation is that it kind of flowed in a natural way. But he actually used the guide to do that so well. And so he set the conversation up. You'll note that he did that, kind of introduced it, ensured that Edward was ready to talk about what they were going to talk about, that he assessed his understanding of the illness and tried to clarify components related to that, which may or may not have been accurate. He shared his prognosis because Edward actually had asked about that. How much time do I have, Doc, is what he had asked. He explored Edward's, you know, his preferences moving forward for medical intervention and what he wanted his family to know and not know and things like that. And then he closed the conversation around helping him to understand, you know, what the next steps were, ensuring that he had an opportunity to ask further questions and had a plan moving forward. So I think all of those kind of key components were embedded within it. And I think it's interesting to see the conversation guide brought to life in that way.
Absolutely. And for you, Dave, anything that you want to sort of flag or sort of key decisions that you felt you were making during the conversation?
Yeah, it really felt like a real patient. He did a great job in his role, and I had the benefit of sitting across from him and watching him. So, it felt like it was a real conversation. And the reality is, it was a real conversation that we have every day. And I will say he was a great patient in the sense that he had already had some background. He had a comfort level of being able to talk about things. So things certainly can go different in these conversations because you certainly don't always get people who are ready to have the conversations. And then there's, you know, that's again where the serious illness conversation tool can come in handy, especially for people who are starting off. It's the way I kind of framed it years ago was, it's nice to see what somebody else's words might be to get started until you get comfortable with your own language. And you will evolve into your own language. And again, I don't even know if I'm following this or not now. It's just the natural part of the way we do things. But especially when you're starting off, it's nice to have a tool like this to be able to guide you a little bit. And sometimes you just borrow that language to get to a place where you need to be. So you will find there's more people that are going to be a little tougher to have some of these conversations with, but this is a great tool to help get there.
Yeah, and I was curious as I was listening to the conversation about whether sometimes these might be the sorts of conversations that occur over multiple visits or multiple discussions. Is that also fairly common that you can sort of almost go in and out of the serious illness conversation guide?
And that's going to depend on the patient and who else is where with them. Sometimes you'll have a patient who's comfortable enough talking about it, but their partner might be with them and they're a lot more distressed with it. And you have to kind of read the room and pace some of that as well, too. The other factor in that, though, is, again, he was a patient who has a prognosis where there is time that you can say, well, let's stop for there. Let's get your symptoms better controlled, and we'll come back and talk more about these things. And that's one of the key things, is pulling all of that together. Because if you're recognizing somebody is getting very close to the end, you have to kind of push through some of that stuff, because it's so important to get, you know, some of these things done for the patient and their family. So it's recognizing how much time you have to, you know, extend the conversation. But usually on our first visits, we'll try to do exactly what you heard today. And then you back it off a little bit if somebody's just not quite ready to be there.
Mm-hmm. So, Sarah, from your perspective, I'm wondering, in terms of the information that you saw being shared in the conversation, sort of as, you know, a healthcare team, what were some of the key bits of information that were shared by Ed in that discussion that would then help inform decision making and care planning going forward?
Yeah, I think he, first of all, recognized and admitted how scared he was, which was perfectly makes so much sense, given, you know, his age and where he's at with the trajectory of his illness. So addressing that, ensuring that's a factor in the decision making, that the people that are, you know, matter most to him, which is where his family members are, part of that and brought along with him. That was something else that I heard loud and clear. I also heard loud and clear that he didn't want to go through any more discomfort or pain, and that he didn't want to draw out his illness any longer than it had to be, you know, for his family primarily. He didn't want to see his family have to suffer based on kind of what was going to happen to him. So I think those are kind of those three things to me really stood out as helping the healthcare provider to understand, okay, so, you know, based on this, what might be some of our next steps? What might be some appropriate, you know, treatments? What are some conversations that we need to have? And what do we need to document from that goals of care perspective, right? Need to ensure that that conversation is finalized by having that documentation piece done as well. And I think Dave does a great job with the goals of care piece, in that he recognizes that it's a lot for people to take in, even just understanding what the concept of the conversation, and then having to go through and look at all of the different levels of intervention. That takes some time for people to get their heads around. So giving people a copy of it to take home, to introduce, to talk to their families, and then to come back and be able to revisit that conversation again and perhaps select that level of intervention and make that decision. But I think the other key thing is that none of these conversations are ever one and done. You know, like Dave said, the idea is that you will revisit this with the patient as their disease changes over time and as their goals and preferences change.
And Dave, is there anything else you'd like to highlight in terms of sort of the information that you were able to gather in the course of the conversation?
Yeah, it was, you can always think afterwards. There's always, geez, I wish I had asked this too. But again, it's recognizing that you don't want to exhaust the person at the same time. And just talking about that follow-up, I think especially in these situations, I don't know how much our healthcare system recognizes the value in follow-up, and that you don't want to leave too much time between the next visit. So when we're in hospital and we have this kind of conversation, usually we're there the next day again too, because it is so much. You don't want to let a lot of time go between, because then there's more chance of even the person not remembering everything. But if you get back right away, it's almost like it solidifies that relationship too. And you can see the trust grow and well, a good example of this is, looking at using the ESAS, the Edmonton Symptom Assessment Scale. Often on your initial visit, or somebody can do an ESAS And if you look at things like anxiety, they could be rating it quite high. You go, you do an intervention, you visit like that, and you go back the next day and you redo the ESAS. And they've noted that often you'll see anxiety down around that 2 or 3 range, where it might have been a 6 or 7 or 8 the day before. It's amazing how powerful just the conversations are, that the person doesn't feel like they're alone in this. They feel like, I can't tell you the times that I've had. And we have the luxury working in palliative care that it's recognized that you need to be able to spend more time with these patients and families, that a lot of other healthcare professions don't get that much time. So I'm not kind of dissing on our colleagues, but so many times people will say, that's the most information I've ever gotten. So whether that's true or they finally were able to kind of hear it in a different way. So those fairly quick follow-ups are immensely important. And I'm not sure how much is recognized. And I think it's something we need to make sure stays in our palliative care realm, despite all the other pressures that are happening. Because if it's kind of a one and done, then, you know, where is that relationship?
So. Yeah. And from the ethics perspective, you know, the importance of that relationship in terms of the experience of both the clinicians who are providing the care as well as the patient and their loved ones who are receiving the care, it's such a critical aspect, and it really facilitates the bringing of values into the conversations. I'm thinking about, you know, you mentioned colleagues in other places that don't have, you know, the same resource of time necessarily built in. I'm wondering what sort of advice or, you know, sort of pearls you might offer those colleagues to, you know, engage in these sorts of conversations in other contexts. So thinking about, you know, rehabilitation or chronic disease management, if there's some things that, you know, people can nonetheless take into conversations in other contexts that will help them, you know, again, build those relationships and get that information that can really help ensure that we're providing, you know, the best patient and family-centered care we can.
Again, I think anybody working anywhere in healthcare, download and have a look at the Serious Illness Conversation sheet, because it's really applicable everywhere. And, you know, I've got a copy here in front of me of a one-page kind of cheat sheet, but that's, you know, almost all you need. Just to give you those ideas. And if you kind of follow that format, it doesn't have to take long. Obviously, in the scenario we provided today, it was somebody with a very serious illness with a lot of medical symptom management, but also a lot of psychosocial practical issues that were there as well, too, that needed to be addressed. So you don't have to do all of that in one visit. But again, with our healthcare system and the pressures on it, being able to do some of this helps to develop some of that trust with the person. So they're going to be able to express their issues more clearly and be able to get to the root of problems quicker. So I think in the long run, if we do this well, we're actually going to be more efficient and effective. So it's investing that little bit extra time, because often 5 more minutes can allow you to do a fair bit.
And from your perspective, Sarah?
Yeah, I would agree with all that Dave said. And I think introducing these conversations as early as possible and as frequently as is appropriate is really the way that we want to go. We don't want to have these conversations in, you know, critical situations or emergency type situations. It shouldn't be the first time someone's had a conversation about their prognosis or understanding of their disease or their goals or their preferences. We need to start these conversations well before. And even when we think about it more globally around like advanced care planning, right? As you know, before I have an illness, before, what is it that I value? What are the things that, you know, I would definitely not even want to consider? What are those cultural considerations for myself that would be really important for healthcare providers to know and providing me care down the road? So backing it up, having advanced care planning conversations with family members, documenting that and providing a copy of that to your healthcare provider can get those conversations started much, much earlier. And I think is really an important piece to highlight.
Thank you so much. This has been a really fantastic session. I feel like I've learned a lot, certainly, from it. And so I'm just wondering if there's anything else that you want to put on the table to spur reflection for folks who've listened to the discussion, or to sort of, again, highlight, you know, just how valuable these sorts of conversations are in providing healthcare. So I don't know, Sarah, shall we go back to you?
Yeah, sure. Just think earlier, I guess, is what I can end off with. Think about it more globally around the advanced care planning piece. Think about having conversations around serious illness and then being able to drill down from there to say, okay, what might that person's goals of care be based on what I've heard in a serious illness conversation, based on what I've captured from reviewing someone's personal directive? Those are the kind of the key pieces of the pie that help to really inform care that's aligned with that person's preferences.
Okay, thank you. Dave?
Yeah, I think for even just some recommendations for people, one is don't fall down the hope well, because sometimes you hear somebody and they're going through a hard time. And because we're human, we want to be very positive with them too. And you hear almost every cancer patient, well, I'm very positive about this. Well, sadly, I'm positive that you're going to die from this disease, you know, is what my sarcastic voice would say, but I keep that in my head most of the time. So it's being open and honest and exploring those things and even identifying things that can come down the road, but also, you know, having that knowledge base to know what can we do about those things that that actually is not, it's healthy and it's helpful. I actually said once in my good friends that do the waiting room revolution, kind of put it in one of their headings of a chapter, was that hope should be the consequence of what we do, not the goal. And that's what you'll find is when you're able to have an open conversation and talk about the reality of what's happening, but talk about what supports and resources we have in place, people often still feel that hopeful feeling that you kind of want them to have as well. So,
terrific. Well, thank you so much, Sarah and Dave, for sharing your expertise and your reflections here. We so appreciate the sort of the time and insight that you've provided us here. And of course, we have deep gratitude going out to Theofani Pastavis for his portrayal of Edward Paul in the conversation, and to Jackie Tillet for the support we've received from the Dalhousie Center for Collaborative Clinical Learning and Research. And we continue, of course, to be grateful for production support from Lisbeth Witthoff-Nielsen, Kristen Lesko-Skerry, and the team at Dalhousie MedIT. Thanks to Ben Capps for our theme music, and most of all, thanks to you for listening. Until next time.